Welcome to my show, Midwife Talks. I'm Lindy Casey, retired midwife. I discuss anything and everything, but mostly women's health, crunchy stuff, and some birth stories. I have a birth story for you today. This occurred back in the 1990s in Southern Nevada. I don't remember the lady's name or her husband, so I'll call them Jeannie and Paul. If this sounds like your birth story, but I wasn't your midwife, it's not your story. I'm in Missouri at the moment, and it's hot. The heat in Missouri is different from Nevada's. I spent over 40 years in Southern Nevada, and I'm familiar with heat, but here in Missouri, it's humid too. It's a challenge. You might hear sweat dripping off of me. I just hope I don't get electrocuted off my microphone. Okay, this particular birth took place in the summer in Nevada in a small apartment in a fairly new complex. Grab yourself a cup of iced tea and let me tell you what being a midwife is really like. It was early in the morning when I got a call from Jeannie that she thought she was in labor. I hadn't been to her apartment before, and I'm not sure why. Usually I did a home visit so that I would be familiar with where in the sprawling complex they lived. Because I wasn't sure how to get to her house, even though I had excellent directions, I quickly set out on the 15-mile drive to her place. Toward the end of my midwifery career, I always told women that they should ignore labor for as long as they could. But this birth took place earlier on, maybe 20 years into my midwifing. At that point, I'd probably told Jeannie to call me when she had some activity, like contractions or rupture of membranes. That's your water breaking. When I got there, it was early enough that the parking lot was pretty full because people hadn't left for work or school or whatever. Since it was a fairly new apartment complex, that means there were only small trees and shrubs on the grounds, and the parking lot had no shade. That meant that I had to park out on the edge, where any shade at all was never going to fall. I knew my car would be an oven out there, but with any luck, Jeannie would be far enough in labor that I wouldn't be there into the heat of the day. Maybe I'd be able to rescue my car from the midday sun and get home early. This was her first baby. She and her husband had been married a year or so. They really seemed compatible and had great senses of humor. Our prenatal appointments were always fun, and we found loads of things to talk about. They were into some interesting stuff like borderline paranormal things, you know, tarot cards and ghost stories, that sort of thing, and they were outspoken about their love and protection of animals. But I think they ate meat, so that's kind of an interesting dichotomy. I always wonder about people who say they love animals and want to protect them, but don't have a problem killing them and eating them anyway. But I digress. Anyway, it's important to me to get to know my clients because it helps me determine later if they're acting normal for them or outrageous or whatever. So those visits beyond the medical stuff, which is obviously necessary, were part of my strategy. There I was pulling up to this hot, sunny parking lot full of cars. I got my gear out of the back of my truck. I had a topper on a little Mazda truck, and that's where I kept all of my gear. When talking about gear, I mean my big bag of tools. Stethoscope, blood pressure cuff, urine testing strips, hemostats, clamps, supplies, etc. Lots of stuff. I also brought a birth stool. Jeannie had said she might want to use it, but really I always brought it. The one I had used to be a yoga headstand thing. It originally had a square sort of seat where your shoulders are supposed to rest and your head goes through a smallish opening. I have never personally tried to do a headstand, so I can't tell you if it was any good for that purpose. But for my purpose, I figured it would work well, and it did. I'd taken it apart and cut a more horseshoe-shaped seat with a bigger opening for it and angled the legs out in front for more access to the business end of birth. It worked pretty good. I slung my bag over one shoulder and the birth stool over the other shoulder and picked up the large plastic tote I used for disposable supplies and wiped the sweat off my forehead. It was already hot, like probably 90 or so, even though it was early. Because it was a big apartment complex, where I parked was a hike from where the apartment was. There was this concrete sidewalk path that sort of meandered between the buildings around until I got to their door. Jeannie answered the door looking way too chipper. I know it sounds horrible, but I like to see a lady unable to talk when I get to her house. That usually means she's deep in the zen of her labor and things are probably progressing. But Jeannie was excited and giggly, and I tried not to groan in frustration. I knew at that point my car was going to be an oven, and I would spend the entire day inside this little apartment. But there was another issue in that apartment. I noticed at the very moment she opened the door, I could smell rodent pee. A lot of rodent pee. Now, at that time in Nevada, rodents weren't actually a problem, or at least I didn't know of them being a problem. I've heard that recently, from importing plants from other areas, there's now a huge rat problem all through the Las Vegas Valley. And when I say rats, I don't mean little lab rats. I mean big Norway or roof rats, New York-style rats, rats that are a foot long. I don't know, maybe I'm exaggerating. But in any case, they're big. At the time Jeannie was having her baby, it would be pretty weird to even have mice in your house, much less rats. Now, I don't get hay fever or any seasonal allergies, but I have an extreme allergic reaction to rodents, specifically rodent urine. If I hold a rodent, even just a guinea pig, I get a rash, but if I breathe their urine-soaked bedding, I can't breathe. My lungs just seize up, and it takes days to recover. So I walk into the apartment, trying to breathe in shallow breaths in hopes that I won't be affected, and there's this thing about cage pee. It's almost like it's moisture in the air, but this is worse than anything I've ever experienced before. The apartment was dark, probably because a lot of people in hot places think that keeping a home dark will make it feel cooler, but it didn't feel cooler. It was warm and it stunk. It took a few minutes for my eyes to become accustomed to the dim light, but when I could see clearly, I was horrified. One entire wall of what should have been a dining room was a bank of wire cages. They were stacked on top of each other and went from the floor to almost the ceiling. I stepped further into the apartment and I could see that each cage held at least one ferret. I have come to understand that ferrets emit a musk, so this was more than just pee. This was a miasmic stench of epic proportions. My eyes began to water, and as I took a shallow breath, there was an audible wheeze coming from my lungs. I said something stupid like, "Oh, you have ferrets." She bubbled over with excitement and began taking them out, one by one, and letting them crawl over her arms and neck. She told me their names. She told me what they loved to eat. She told me about their personalities. Finally, she paused, and I had a chance to ask her how she was feeling. What she described was probably very early labor. Her husband was home from work because she, quote-unquote, needed him, and he came out of a doorway to join her in enthusiastically describing every twinge she was feeling. And so my day began. Usually, when I get to a lady's house, I spend a few minutes breaking the ice. There's this expectation that when the midwife arrives, stuff is gonna get real. But in actuality, any change in her perception of labor is almost always psychological. Obviously, there are exceptions, and because of that, I don't assume anything. Occasionally, a lady is cool as a cucumber, and she's 8 centimeters dilated, but usually I can tell just by watching her demeanor how far along she is. One mistake that new midwives and many, many doulas make is to announce how far along in labor the client is just by her behavior. The problem with that is that you set her up for an expectation that really has no basis in fact. When you say, "I can tell by the sounds you're making that you're in transition," she often will subconsciously start making more of the same sounds because she wants so badly for it to be true. But in this case, Jeannie was acting so relaxed and comfortable that I didn't have high confidence in her being very far along at all. Also, her husband had been charting every contraction, like he had a little notebook and he had written down every contraction. So much for ignoring it as long as you can. It's pretty hard to ignore something you're paying close attention to and announcing every time it occurs. I found a place to unload my gear in the couple's bedroom and suggested I take a listen to the baby's heart rate. I've always used a Doppler fetoscope. It basically bounces sound waves off soft tissue, and it's a fast and easy way to count a fetal heart rate. Jeannie lay down on her bed and happily pulled her shirt up so I could apply a little gel. Because I always kept notes on every aspect of care, I knew right where I would probably find the loudest and clearest heart tone. While babies can and sometimes do adjust their positions in late pregnancy, usually they're in the same general area they were in the last weeks. Her baby sounded good, which is to say the heartbeats per minute fell into the 120 to 160 beats per minute range. I listened through a contraction to make sure the baby was tolerating labor well. A word about fetal heart rates. When you, say, run up some stairs or rush on an errand or get suddenly frightened or startled, your heart beats faster, which makes your pulse or heart rate higher. On the other hand, when you're sleeping or super relaxed, your pulse will probably be slower if you're a healthy person. And if something happens to interfere with your health, like sickness or injury, your heart will compensate and react, and the beats per minute will change. Fetal bodies work the same way as bigger bodies. When a care provider listens to a fetal heart, they're reading beats per minute, cadence, etc. These things can be indicators of health. At that moment, I could feel my heart racing, trying to pump oxygen to my cells because every breath was a wheeze. I just couldn't breathe. Even though we were in a bedroom, further away from the wall of ferret cages, the entire apartment was permeated with the scent and presumably the molecules of rodent urine. I didn't want to impose my own situation on Jeannie and Paul's experience, so I didn't say anything. I know there are midwives who share their own trials and tribulations at birth. Years later, the mother is incorporated and still includes those details into her own birth story. I don't think that's fair. Not to mention that, hearing I was having what sounded like an asthma attack during her labor could cause her to have fear or anxiety. I continued with my assessment of Jeannie's vital signs while trying to breathe. Jeannie's vitals were fine, but she was anxious to know what her dilation was. Dilation is a measurement of how open the cervix is. The baby eventually exits the uterus by first going through the cervix, and that ordinarily happens at about 10 centimeters. The other cervical measurements that we often think are important are how long the cervix is, which is known as effacement, and how soft it is. If it's long, closed, and firm, there's a lot of work to be done. If it's 50% effaced, soft like your lips, and 3 centimeters, you're probably in early labor, or you've had a few babies before. If it's 100% effaced or completely thinned and 10 centimeters dilated, you'll probably be pushing soon. Jeannie was the former. Early labor, not even active labor, really. I knew I couldn't stay in that house for hours and hours more without having a backup plan. So there I was in this warm and stuffy and stinky apartment, wheezing, with a lady who would, in all likelihood, be in labor for hours more. I figured she'd deliver in the evening. It was early morning. I suggested she try to rest and ignore her contractions while I ran an errand. Okay, here is a secret. Midwives often run an errand or go check on something to get out of a house. I left Jeannie and Paul's apartment and drove down the road to a 7-Eleven and bought a Bickle. And I called another midwife. Kay and I used to be midwifery partners, but some other people pulled some really shady stuff and caused a rift between us. However, we healed that rift and remained friends and often worked together still, even though we weren't partners anymore. I explained what was going on and she jumped at the chance to spend the day together. I waited for her at the 7-Eleven, and when she drove up, I felt immense relief. My breathing had improved once I got out of the apartment, but I knew that when I went back inside, I'd be in the same boat again, struggling to get air into my lungs. I needed to know someone else would be there for Jeannie if it all just became too much for me. But instead of going right back, Kay and I went to a secondhand store and shopped. We ate lunch. We drove around. Eventually, Jeannie called me. Here's how calls to a midwife often work. The lady is the first to call in early labor. She's excited and believes it's the real thing. I try to keep her on the phone for at least as long as she says her contractions are apart. So, for instance, if she says she's having pains every 10 minutes that last for 45 seconds, I keep her talking for more than 10 minutes. If I can't hear a change in her voice or breathing during that time, I'll ask if she's had any contractions while we've been talking. If she says yes, I'll ask her if she wants me to check her or if she thinks she's good on her own a little longer. She will usually say that particular contraction was a mild one. Why is that, you might ask? On the one hand, it could have been a mild contraction in a string of stronger ones. It could be, maybe. On the other hand, it might be that she was so focused on each contraction before our conversation that she magnified their intensity. The distraction of talking to me took her mind off of them, so it seemed much milder. In active labor, you usually can't distract yourself from them that way. If I hear her voice get weaker or trail off, or if she breathes heavy for 20 or 30 seconds, I figure things are probably happening. But I could be wrong. That's why I always ask if she wants me to come. I trust her judgment, even if I don't agree with her assessment. If the lady says she's good for a little longer, the next call often starts with her, but she hands the phone off to her partner midway when a contraction starts. He tries to convey what's going on. Again, I'll ask if they want me to come and check on them. Sometimes they'll say no. Sometimes, especially if they live some distance away or weather is a concern, they'll ask me to come. But if they don't, the very next call I get is the husband sounding stressed, and I can hear the lady in the background sounding like things just got real. Things that can interfere with an assessment over the phone can be the couple's anxiety, a history of traumatic birth or abuse, or a friend's experience that makes them worried that the same thing could happen to them. In this case, Jeannie asked me to come check on her, even though she sounded quite chipper. Kay and I left my truck in the shade of a building and drove back over in her truck. Kay loved animals. She loved dogs and cats and lizards. She especially loved ferrets. I think it had to do with how they're like a ribbon, winding themselves around your arm or neck. I think she liked the fluidity of their movements. Immediately when we came into the apartment, Kay wanted to play with the ferrets. Jeannie got one out and handed it to her, and I set the gear back up. Back then, Kay and I checked dilation almost as often as doctors did. Toward the end of my career as a midwife, I didn't do it as frequently. There were even quite a few births where I never did an internal examination. But back then, that was considered standard of care, so I went through the whole exam again. A funny thing happened the second time I went into that apartment. My wheezing was immediately as bad as it had worked up to be when I was there before, and my eyes were itching. I blinked a few times since I had gloves on and couldn't rub my eyes while I told Jeannie she was about 6 centimeters, and her cervix was thinner and softer. Her baby was doing well and her labor was progressing nicely. Kay and I would not be leaving. To entertain ourselves, we talked with Paul while Kay played with the ferrets. Jeannie labored on, but she was fully engaged in our conversation between contractions. Except for the fact that I couldn't breathe, it was a nice time just hanging out and occasionally checking vitals. Every breath was becoming an ordeal, though. I'd breathe in, but I felt like it didn't go anywhere. I'd try to exhale harder to make more room for fresh air, but it only worked every once in a while. Over time, I started feeling really not okay. I probably hyperventilated a few times in the effort to breathe because my fingertips and lips felt fuzzy and tingly. I wasn't even sure I was thinking straight. Something changed about the way Jeannie was acting, so I checked her and she was fully dilated and 100%, which means she was ready to push. The problem with that way of thinking, which was almost universal at that time, is that there's more to getting an urge to push than just being dilated. Pushing is easier and more effective if you wait for the urge to push or ejection reflex. Some people equate the urge to push with having a bowel movement, but I think it's more like throwing up. If you have a strong gag reflex, the following description might affect you. Side note, it doesn't bother me at all to see someone throw up. When you're sick, the urge to puke comes on slowly. Your mouth might flood with spit, and at some point you realize it's inevitable. When you first gag, you don't actually vomit. It's sort of a little practice gag, and then it progresses to an uncontrollable, whole-body effort to puke. You probably can't hold it off for long. Your stomach clenches, your mouth opens, you vomit in a surge of strength. And then the wave is passed, and you sit back on your heels in front of the porcelain throne in your bathroom. The urge to push is very much the same. At first you feel a little sensation of pushing, and you might say, "I'm not doing that. My body is doing that. I'm not doing that." Interestingly, sometimes a lady will actually throw up as she gains that urge to push. Anyway, as the push grows, it becomes inevitable. The body clenches, the whole body bears down, she might grimace, and her body pushes in a surge, almost like a jerk. Those pushes are usually much more effective than the old school way of guided pushing without any urge. That's not to say there isn't a time and a place for telling a lady she has to push when she doesn't feel like it, but if the baby is tolerating labor, a midwife can usually wait for her to have that urge. But back then, only 20 years into my midwifery career, I told Jeannie that with the next contraction, she could push. Now, Kay didn't know it, but I was seriously oxygen deprived by this point. She was busy playing with the ferrets and gazing adoringly at Jeannie's efforts to push while sitting on the birth stool. I was sitting cross-legged on the floor in front of her, and Kay was standing to my left with a ferret wrapped around her arm. Jeannie pushed well. With each surge, the head came lower until I could see her vulva begin to bulge. The head was moving through her bones, through her pelvis. Fetal heart tones were good and moving down, another sign that the baby was descending nicely. But I noticed something. As the baby's head came into view, it retreated after the contraction more than usual. This is something we refer to as turtling. Like a turtle sticks its head out with its neck stretched out and then pulls it back in, it's usually a sign that the baby is big and the shoulders are interfering in birth. Imagine stretching your head up as far as you can. Your shoulders go down a little, your neck stretches out very far. In the case of birth, the shoulders need to enter the pelvis in a certain position to be able to fit. If they don't enter just right, or if the baby is so fat that the shoulders are bigger than the head, every push just shoves those shoulders back and there's no real progress. It can even lead to the head coming out, but the shoulders remain stuck behind the pubic bone. It can be fatal to the baby. Because I was seeing this turtling, I was on high alert. And remember, when we are on high alert, what happens? We breathe fast and our heart rate goes up. But unfortunately, I couldn't breathe deeper, so my heart wasn't able to pump oxygenated blood fast enough to compensate for my heightened alert, and I got dizzy. Really dizzy. The head was born, but the shoulders didn't come. From my vantage point, I could see what Kay couldn't. The baby was opening and closing its mouth. Its face was turning dark. I told Jeannie to get off the stool and get on all fours, but she was confused at this change of plan and instead plopped down on her butt. She lay back and gave a half-hearted push. I tried to rotate the baby's shoulders to get them through her pelvis, but they were too wedged in place from Jeannie's earlier and very effective pushing. I tried to get one finger into the baby's armpit, and I looked up at Kay, sparkling in my peripheral vision as I felt like I was going to pass out. I thought I was going to faint from this lack of oxygen, and no one would notice that this baby was stuck. I can still see it in my mind's eye. Kay standing there to my left, smiling, waiting for that magical moment of birth, blissfully unaware. I managed to gasp out, "Help me." She didn't question me. She just dropped to the floor and helped me push Jeannie's knees back, and together we got that juicy baby out. And all was well. They named that 9-pounder after a feral animal. That's all I'm going to say about that. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening, and remember, if you want to support what I do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. I'll see you in the next episode of Midwife Talks.